On the Same Page, a Good Omens fan fiction by Chekhov, read by Gorilla's Gal 86. Part 4. Chapter 5. It was nothing short of a miracle that he'd made it this far. This far being the bottom of the steps. That was far enough for him as it was. Going away, leaving his shop, his books, for a whole week? No longer than that, 11 days. It was unthinkable. What was more unthinkable was that he would be spending those days with Crowley as his husband. It was almost too much. He didn't know how he would even make it to the airport and face Gabriel without spontaneously combusting on the way. He didn't know how he would face Crowley at the airport without combusting. The last thing he needed was to have his ridiculous lack of self-control parading around in broad daylight. It turned out he didn't really have a choice. Like a curse of some sort disguised as a miracle, Crowley descended on his bookshop 10 minutes prior to his departure, threw open the doors, and began his career as a method actor.
Xerophil, we're going to be late. Are you seriously not ready yet?
I'm coming. I told you. You didn't have to come get me.
I clearly did, because you're not even ready. My car is right here. Won't make a difference if I leave now. Stop kissing your individual books goodbye and get on with it. Where's your luggage?
Behind the register.
I'll get it. Just hurry with... Wait, is that all?
It's the tartan one by the desk.
I bloody know it's the tartan one. The problem is the one. You only have one bag.
How many are you bringing?
Hell of a lot more than that. Listen, you do know what snow is, don't you? White, clumpy stuff? The other white, clumpy stuff? Falls from the sky? It's cold? It makes you cold? Has it ever occurred to you that it's cold in America?
I'll ask you don't judge my choice in packing. Thank you very much. I'm a 46-year-old man. I think I can figure out how to dress myself.
Good Lord, what are you wearing?
What? It's my best shirt. Has it ever occurred to you it's cold in America? I'm a 46-year-old man. I can dress myself, and I've got a jacket.
In one of my mini bags, which are in the car, unlike you.
I'll be in the car soon enough. With your driving, we'll be there early anyway.
Crowley grumbled under his breath in reply and paced nervously at the door as if he was the one who was gambling his career on this ridiculous scheme. As if his head was on the chopping block. It wasn't, and it wouldn't ever be. He was, at this point, anonymous enough to slip through life unnoticed, as long as you didn't catch the name on his ID. Which he rarely used these days, because he had the money to manufacture fake ones. When questioned by his ear fail, he waved it off and said he was supporting local artists. In the end, his ear fail was right. They were not late. The combination of his careful survey of traffic and Crowley's lack of respect for the lanes painted into the tarmac worked in beautiful harmony to get them to the airport in a prompt manner.
Not that I'm not grateful, he said when they finally climbed out, miraculously unscathed by both laws of physics and the laws of London's traffic ordinance, and gathered their luggage.
But why did you come and pick me up?
Insurance, replied Crowley, adjusting his glasses, adjusting his shirt collar, adjusting his hair. Each movement was controlled, precise, and an utter betrayal of the fact that he was almost as anxious about this as Xerophil was.
It's more natural if we come together. Supposed to be married, aren't we?
Yes, but we're not even in America yet, replied Xerophil. And Gabriel's supposed to... Oh, bugger.
there he is. And there he was, grinning and wearing some ridiculously expensive scarf and approaching them like an airliner coming in for a landing, arms spread wide and making a ridiculous amount of noise. "Aziraphale!" He boomed cheerfully. "Wow, you weren't kidding." He was staring straight at Crowley, who bared his teeth in a vague, animal-like approximation of a smile, and punched the author's arm cheerfully. "That's much better than what I expected." Rubbing his arm where it had suffered the unnecessary wound of manly bonding rituals, Aziraphale slapped together something that was meant to resemble a tolerant smile. Taking no notice of this, Gabriel returned to inspecting Crowley almost critically. "Honestly, I'm a little surprised. I kind of thought you would, you know..." The editor turned back to Aziraphale and lowered his voice. "Go for something less subtle. But seriously, if you need to pay him off, as long as this goes well, I'll cut you a check to cover the..." "Gabriel," Aziraphale interrupted hurriedly, "please." "Not to worry," said Crowley, seeing his chance and homing in on it. "He's paying me in other ways." The shock on Gabriel's face seemed to be enough to satisfy him, and the next grin was a bit more legitimate, and somehow even more animalistic. "He's joking," Aziraphale countered quickly before his editor could direct the scandalized gaze at him. "He likes to play pranks on people. He's an old acquaintance." "Oh?" asked Gabriel, adjusting his jacket and giving Crowley another once-over. "Didn't know Aziraphale had those. Are you also in the book business?" "You could say that," replied Crowley, winding up another shit-eating grin. "He's a lawyer," inserted Aziraphale before another disaster could occur. When Crowley whipped his head around to protest, he not so subtly stepped on the man's foot and plastered on an intense, innocent smile. "He deals mostly with copyright infringement cases." "Yikes," said Gabriel sympathetically. "Yikes," agreed Crowley, though he was looking at Aziraphale now, his lips pursed. Aziraphale removed his foot and tugged on his bow tie self-consciously. "Shall we check in?" The attempt to prompt the party towards some sort of resolution was half-lived. Although they did pick up the bags and move to the passport check, while stuck in line, Gabriel seemed to become restless without positive social feedback and honed in on Crowley as his next potential victim. "You must deal with a lot of poor literature in your line of work," he began. And Crowley, whether of his own accord or responding to Aziraphale's knowing eye roll, visibly braced for the punchline. "You haven't happened to run across any lawsuits regarding pornographic literature, have you?" Arching his eyebrows and puckering his lips in a flashingly failing display of casualty, the husband's stand-in shifted from one foot to the other. "Nah, I can't really recall any, to be honest. Not my field." "Really?" Gabriel frowned a bit. "I imagine you deal with the lowest of the low in court. Obscene works fall under that umbrella, surely." "Well, it's, Crowley shoved his hands deeper into his pockets and looked around for an excuse. "It's more complicated than that, the law is. Got lots of, departments, lots of subspecialties. And DAs, for example. Subpoena. Sequestration." He was clearly picking words randomly categorized under law jargon out of a hat. And thankfully, Gabriel seemed none the wiser. "I personally deal with the copyright clauses, such as, He shot a look at Aziraphale, as if he couldn't help habitually seeking help in him. Such as the Anne Rice C&D debacle." Beside him, Aziraphale stifled his laughter with a well-timed coughing fit. But Gabriel nodded sympathetically and said, "Ah, of course. Most of the sympathy was reserved for himself, given that Crowley had burned his only bridge to the conversation he actually wanted to have, and he was now forced to seek another way to get there. Whether out of his own masochistic curiosity or out of the need to repay Aziraphale for throwing him under the bus, Crowley decided to cooperate. "Why do you ask?" he inquired. Gabriel lit up, then hurried to school it into a concerned frown. "Oh, just a professional curiosity, I suppose. I have a specific author in mind, you see, who I'm sure is guilty of at least some lawbreaking." Without waiting for the other to even finish his neutral grunt, Gabriel plowed ahead. "Have you ever heard of Antony J. Crowley?" Antony J. Crowley's eyebrows climbed and his mouth spasmed into a delighted grin. "Can't say that I have," he replied cheerfully. "Oh, well, let me tell you," Gabriel began, and proceeded to do just that. Aziraphale observed in silent horror as Crowley's face journey completed all of the natural stages of absolute joy, like a child being handed a gift to unwrap. He listened along with Gabriel's tirade with genuine interest now, nodding and even adding "Azuki" when the editor paused to take a breath between paragraphs of airing his usual grievances. It was difficult to say which one of them was enjoying the conversation more. Gabriel, who was finally having his viewpoint vehemently validated. Or Crowley, who was learning of his horrible reputation with the exhilaration of a criminal mastermind seeing his face on a wanted poster for the first time. While this brilliant, almost friendship was unfolding right in front of him, Aziraphale watched the line to the passport check-in dwindling. The person ahead of them stepped away to the counter, and finally it seemed like there was a light at the end of the tunnel. Once they were past security, he could finally stop worrying about Gabriel realizing who he was talking to, and start worrying about the next thing on the list. The airline attendant glanced up and motioned to him, and Aziraphale immediately turned around, eager to separate his editor from his ticking time bomb of a husband. Not husband. He had to remind himself vigorously, and shook his head to clear it. "Look, we're next. You go first, Crowley glanced back at him, and in that split second, Aziraphale realized what he was about to do. It was like being in a tram with two diverging tracks. Tied to one end of the tracks was his cover, about to be blown. Tied to the other was his dignity. He pulled the lever. "You go first, Crumpet." Crowley's mouth jumped into a delighted grin. "Crumpet?" he repeated. Gabriel seemed equally startled. "Getting into character already, are we? There's a good man." He patted Aziraphale's shoulder roughly and then winced with theatrical effects. "Maybe tone it down, though. Crumpet's a bit..." "Right," Aziraphale said weakly, closing his eyes to deal with the embarrassment without having to look at Crowley's thrilled expression. "You can call me whatever you want," Crowley assured him. "Angel." Like a slowed-down action shot in a film that was meant to showcase the depth of the mistake someone had made a moment before, Aziraphale's eyes drifted open and locked on him. Crowley's smile fell by a minute degree, and in several frames, the realization that he had crossed a line weighed heavily on his brow. He appeared to be remembering that he was not the only one who had ammunition for this gunfight. "Off you go, then," Aziraphale said icily. "Darling." The pet name hit like a silver bullet. Crowley's jaw tightened, and he turned a peculiar shade of pink, but said nothing else. Just grabbed his suitcases and plowed past Aziraphale and towards the counter. It wasn't like Aziraphale didn't feel bad. One might call this hitting below the belt. Though perhaps hitting was the wrong word for what that particular moniker had done to him in the past. The location was accurate. But Crowley had started it. He knew that Aziraphale tried to keep his association with his old username as secret as possible, and he knew that it was something they were only allowed to joke about after two or three drinks, and never out in public, with Gabriel right there. 3 minutes later, once Crowley's suitcases were loaded onto the conveyor belt and they had both shuffled out towards the line for the security check, at least one issue resolved itself. Gabriel finally bid them goodbye. Never mind that they had barely spent 20 minutes around each other. It was already too long for Aziraphale. The feeling wasn't exactly mutual. "Well," Gabriel said to him, raising his eyebrows meaningfully, "I hate to leave, but I'm afraid it's on you from this point onward." "Right," said Aziraphale. "Don't let this opportunity go to waste." "Of course," said Aziraphale again. "I'm serious, don't mess this up."
"I won't."
He cleared his throat nervously and adjusted the carry-on bag on his shoulder. "We won't," Crowley said, apparently having recalibrated himself to his usual level of troublemaking. He slung an arm around Aziraphale's shoulders. Gabriel's smile twitched, but he reached out a hand. "And it was great meeting you, call me Ashtoreth," supplied Crowley, seizing his fingers with minimal brevity for politeness' sake. "Don't worry, I'll make sure this one stays out of trouble." "Excellent," chuckled Gabriel and seemed encouraged, plowed onward. "And make sure he stays out of the eggnog. And the Christmas turkey, or whatever it is they have over there. I keep telling him he won't fit in the frame for his next author photo if he keeps up like this." Aziraphale sagged, already preemptively preparing himself for the incoming storm. But in a stark contrast to his quick surrender, Crowley seemed to be tensing unnaturally beside him. The arm on his shoulders, which had previously been hovering in an awkward imitation of casual familiarity, suddenly turned laden. Fingers curled into his shoulder, and Aziraphale would have felt flustered if he wasn't more concerned with the abrupt change in the tone of Crowley's voice.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
Gabriel cut his sentence short, startled properly for once, and then hurried to recover with a sardonic smile. "Well, you have to admit, he's getting a bit soft." Crowley's lounge against Aziraphale's side straightened, a snake about to strike. "What's wrong with that?" he hissed. An awkward silence clanged into the space between them, ringing in Aziraphale's ears despite the stark lack of noise. The voices of the airport suddenly seemed far away, and the only thing he was aware of was Crowley's crackling fury, the way he could almost hear the other's quickening pulse. The heat of it was like a warm campfire, in contrast to Gabriel's usual cold disappointment. In the midst of it, he had completely forgotten to feel bad about the way he looked, and instead found himself leaning into the flame, feeling a flare of gratefulness echoing in response to Crowley's cacophonous, righteous anger. But he couldn't bask forever. Gabriel was still staring. Everything was quiet in the most uncomfortable way possible.
"We better get a wiggle on,"
he said, cutting through the tension like a warm knife through butter. "A boarding starts soon." Crowley whipped his head around to him.
"Huh? The plane,"
Aziraphale clarified. "It's leaving, and we have to be on it." "Yeah, I got that part," grumbled Crowley, and disappointingly released his grip on Aziraphale's shoulder. "It was the wiggle on." Waving cordially to Gabriel, who still seemed shell-shocked by the U-turn of character, Aziraphale led them away. They remained silent until they were past the taped-off lineup and finally reached the scanners, but this seemed to be the limit for his companion. In the process of removing his boots and throwing his wallet into the plastic bins, he immediately launched into a quiet but hissy tirade.
"The nerve! What the fuck does he...
Why does it bloody matter what you look like? What business is it of his? Who the fuck does he think he is to fucking get?
Zierfield glanced at him out of the corner of his eye. Calm down. He's quite right, he murmured. I have been letting myself go.
He's a sodding bastard is what he is,
Crowley snarled. You look fine. His cheeks were warming, threatening to shift color, and Azirfield did his best to convince them to abandon the endeavor. Don't forget to take off your sunglasses, he said instead of replying directly, and turned away to remove his own cardigan and toss it into the next bin along with his keys. Once they'd been put through the ringer, which involved Zierfield going back and forth several times to pull several coins and pins out of his various pockets, they stepped out into the stretch of hallway leading towards the gates, and finally, it felt like they could breathe. Zierfield rolled his shoulders, checked his watch, and then glanced at Crowley, who was still standing around, looking rather sulkily at the gift shops. You're cold, he said. It wasn't a question, more of an observation. Crowley was always too cool to shiver properly, but there were other telltale signs, like the way he was pressing his elbows in, trying to wrap around himself like a boa. It'll be even worse on the plane. Haven't you got a jacket? Crowley sniffed and crossed his arms over his chest moodily. Several. Azirfil raised his eyebrows. And? He prompted. They're in my luggage, Crowley muttered. In your luggage? Azirfil thought for a moment, glanced around, and confirmed that none of the aforementioned luggage was in sight. It finally dawned on him. The ones you checked in? Yeah. And your carry-on. Checked that in, too. Azirfield began to open his mouth to ask why before hurriedly reconsidering. Crowley's ears were red, and although there was a chance it was from his chill, there was also the possibility that Azirfield's choice of pet name back at the passport counter had startled him enough to not be thinking clearly when he'd gone in. If that were truly the case, it was technically his fault. Oh, good Lord. He said and pulled his own bag down before shrugging his cream-colored knit cardigan off again. Here. What? Crowley was pointedly looking elsewhere. When Azirfield nudged his arm, he glanced down and scrunched up his nose like a cat being offered a piece of vegetable. What's that for? It's a sweater. Put it on, replied Azirfield. You do know the function of a sweater, don't you? Crowley grabbed the offensive garment, though he continued to look displeased about it even as he shrugged his skinny arms into the large sleeves. It doesn't exactly match my ensemble. Oh, hush, replied Azirfield. You won't match my ensemble if you catch a cold on the way. What kind of husband am I going to look like if I can't even keep you from getting sick? He glanced up at the same time as Crowley did and caught his own reflection in the dark sunglasses. He was smiling. He hadn't realized he was doing it and promptly instructed his face to stop. Crowley's mouth spasmed like he was fighting a similarly embarrassing expression. Thanks, Angel. Azirfield inhaled, ready to tell him off, but deflated at the last moment. Gabriel wasn't around anymore, and frankly, as far as terms of endearment went, this one was significantly better than the alternatives he was sure Crowley was capable of thinking up. Of course, dear, he said in reply, as saccharine as he could make it, and reached up to adjust the sweater collar. It worked wonders for shutting the other up, and Azirfield idly wondered why he didn't employ this tactic more often. Then, as he pulled away, his hand brushed Crowley's own, and he remembered the reason at once. They both flinched apart as if electrocuted,
and hurried to return to adjusting their own clothes in self-defense while the feeling of skin-to-skin contact died down. Aziraphale mentally scolded himself. He'd been good about this for 6 years. For 6 years, he had kept Crowley more or less at arm's length, kept things cordial, maintained the atmosphere, and built his walls. And Crowley had been cooperating for those 6 years. They never discussed it, they never talked about it, even if they both knew. They were on the same page. They always were. They had to be. And now in the span of less than a few hours, things were coming apart at the seams. Pet names were clawing their way from the floorboards. His old desires, once buried and shut up in a tomb of control and repression, were shaking the limestone walls apart, tearing their way out of the prison with the ease of an ocean wave crashing through a sandcastle. And the fake marriage was there, holding a shovel, ready to go grave digging, an archaeological site warrant in hand. But no, self-introspection was not something they had time for. Aziraphale surfaced from the metaphorical dirt, taking a much-needed gulp of fresh air. We should head to the gate, the plane. It's been delayed. As proof, Crowley extracted his phone and showed him the display. I got an update an hour ago. Oh. Aziraphale squinted at the screen for a moment, befuddled. Why didn't you mention it earlier? I wanted to get away from that wanker Gabriel as fast as we could, said Crowley with a reminiscent scowl. Then he wiped it off his face and looked back at Aziraphale, lifting his eyebrows. The expression cleared, and there was an upward curve to his lips, the same way there always was when he would saunter into the bookshop right after nightfall with a pair of tickets to some jazz concert at an underground bar. Fancy a spot of lunch? He chirped. They were creatures of habit, really, with enough repetition, intentional or not. Anything can become a routine. Morning tea standing by the window looking out at the street, tapping your shoes on the door 3 times before coming in, having a wank in the mornings when you dream of the person you know you can't touch, but want to anyway. Seeing that person sneak in despite the close sign on the bookshop door in order to tempt you with all manner of things. Bottles of wine, apple turnovers, orchestra tickets. Putting on an act of protest for the sake of it, only to inevitably cave and agree to go 5 minutes later. Aziraphale had his habits. More importantly, now he had a chance to let them run wild a bit. He had more than a week to indulge, to get used to the feeling of having things he couldn't regularly have, to treasure those things. Right there, in the middle of the airport, he didn't even have to worry about keeping up appearances. He was pretending to be married to Crowley. They could just go out to lunch in plain sight and it would be completely justified. They could technically hold hands. They could even... No, that might be overstepping it. But they could go to lunch. The feeling alone cracked his chest open in a burst of golden light he could feel spilling forth from inside him, an earthquake of pure, unabated joy. Still, there were rituals. He wiggled his shoulders and narrowed his eyes at the other for a few seconds as if he was about to argue, and then put on a dramatic sigh of defeat, even threw an eye roll in for good measure. "Oh, all right, you old serpent," he said. "I'll bite." Crowley lit up and jutted out an elbow, and for the first time in 6 years, Aziraphale took it and stepped into his side. He had 11 days left. He was not about to let them go to waste. Chapter 6. Aziraphale had been on plenty of planes before. Big ones, small ones, comfortable ones, stuffy ones. But he'd never been sat next to a literal demon. Which was precisely what Crowley proved himself to be 30 minutes after takeoff. First, he demanded the window seat. But after the plane gained enough altitude, the view apparently disturbed more than it interested him, and he insisted on switching seats, which forced an awkward 90-second tessellation of both of them and the unfortunate woman seated in the aisle chair. She tried to lean away to make enough room, but after hearing Crowley threaten to climb up over Aziraphale's lap, changed her mind and stood up. After they were settled again, Aziraphale leaned forward and gave her an apologetic look and said, "I'm awfully sorry." But she didn't appear soothed by this. She instead continued to shoot them strange glances over the next hour or so. And she had good reason to. Spending any amount of time within proximity to Crowley was chaotic enough in and of itself. He complained about the cushions, wiggled his legs up against the seat in front of him until Aziraphale scolded him for disturbing the next row up, and then tried to fold them down again, only succeeding in kicking Aziraphale's carry-on bag around on the floor. He kicked off his shoes as well, and then contorted himself into a pretzel shape looking for them for another 10 minutes afterward. He complained about not getting first-class tickets, and then complained about the time he did get first-class tickets. Then he just complained. Overall, this was not new. Aziraphale was used to two things, Crowley and his restless energy. The third thing, being trapped in a metal tube a foot away from Crowley, was a novel experience. It was not a pretty addition to the equation, and he wasn't quite sure that he was a fan. It would be tolerable, though, he thought, if Crowley was disturbing him instead of the others. Instead, he seemed dead set on making life for the passengers around them as mildly uncomfortable as he could, which in turn meant making Aziraphale uncomfortable through the sheer power of determination and second-hand embarrassment. The bulk of this hard work was directed at the poor woman with the misfortune of being next to them, who, to Aziraphale's knowledge, had done nothing to deserve it. That was his assumption, at least, until they were about 2 hours into the flight and everything started to settle down. Crowley had evidently grown tired enough to wiggle down into a shape resembling a 3-year-old scribble and was reading something on his phone. Aziraphale was similarly engaged to a book he'd brought along. The woman on the end of their seat island was, presumably, napping. At one point, Crowley must have seen something he liked and instinctively leaned across the seat, offering up his phone to Aziraphale. "Angel, get a load of this Twitter thread," he said. Aziraphale didn't actually remember what it was specifically. He remembered something about the accuracy of a Wikipedia page on Chevalier Dion, and a long line of expletives and emojis, but overall it didn't matter, because the conversation was quickly interrupted by a sharp intake of breath beside them. They both stilled and looked over at the woman, who had been the one to make the noise. She was looking at them out of the corner of her eye, even more disapprovingly than before. A bit unfair, thought Aziraphale, given that Crowley was, by then, on his best behavior, and she had nothing to complain about. "You've got no right," she said very quietly. "I beg your pardon," he asked, since Crowley, uncharacteristically, did not offer up a comment. He didn't seem nearly as befuddled by the interjection for some reason. "Calling each other that holy word. That sort of word has no place in your mouth." Her voice, having started out as soft, was now rising to be quite audible above the rumble of the engines. "Don't you know you're both going to hell?" The realization of what was happening was quick and quite sobering. "Ah," said Aziraphale, dropping all pretense of civility. He shut his book and reached up to remove his reading glasses, ignoring the cold lump he felt in his throat. It really shouldn't have come as a surprise. This did happen sometimes when he and Crowley were out together, and he was more or less used to it. "I'm sorry, but what do you mean?" Crowley suddenly voiced from beside him in the strangest, fakest pitch he'd ever employed. Both the woman and Aziraphale directed their befuddled gazes to him.
"What do I mean?"
she repeated, incredulous.
"I mean you are going to hell. That lifestyle you're leading, it's a sin."
Crowley sat up a bit straighter, though perhaps straight was the wrong term. He arranged himself into a more vertical shape, and thanks to the length of his body, still somehow ended up fluidly draped over both his and Aziraphale's chair. Then he propped up his chin on the palm of his hand and tilted his head a very deliberate 45 degrees to the right.
"What does sin mean?"
he asked. Aziraphale blinked. The woman blinked too. Neither of them spoke for a while. Finally, she said,
"A sin. A bad thing against God."
It almost sounded as if she wasn't sure. Crowley yanked up his eyebrows well above the line of his sunglasses.
"Against who?"
he inquired quizzically.
"Oh, good Lord,"
thought Aziraphale to himself. He wanted to say something, anything, but some repressed part of him rebelled at the idea of interrupting this social experiment Crowley was apparently putting on. What's more, now that the woman was facing more towards them, he could see the t-shirt she was wearing. It said, "Sinners repent or face the wrath of Satan," and had a long list which apparently included more categories than he was familiar with. He could make out witches and homosexuals at the top of the list and presumed it continued in much the same fashion all the way down. Suddenly, Crowley's insistence at being absolutely intolerable for the first hour of the flight seemed a bit more justified, and Aziraphale felt slightly less bad about everything else he had done. Meanwhile, the social experiment continued.
"God," the woman said. "The Lord, the Almighty Creator."
Crowley shook his head. "Never heard of her. She's some new pop star you got in America?"
"He."
The correction was immediate and unreasonably irritated for the subject matter.
"God is not a pop star. God is... he's... you've never heard of God."
"Nope," replied Crowley, cheerfully popping the pea.
"The Bible. You've never read the Bible?"
"Is that a magazine of some sort?"
It's a book."
"Oh, I don't read books."
"But surely you've... what about church? You've never been to church?"
"Been lots of places," Crowley informed her, still violently cheerful.
"Don't see what it has to do with any books or any... what did you call this bloke? God, was it?"
If it were possible to vibrate through fabric, out of sheer shock, the woman's chair would have certainly begun to suffer the consequences now.
"He's not a bloke. He's our Lord, the God, the Savior. It's in the Bible. Jesus, surely you've heard of Jesus."
Crowley vehemently denied it, and then he vehemently denied everything else. The deeper the hole was dug, the more eagerly he stomped down any dirt thrown at him. The dedication, the commitment to every vacant...
"What do you mean, faith? What is that? Can I eat it?"
And every absolutely nonsensical, "I've never heard of this Christmas, as you call it. Are you sure it's that popular? We don't have it where I come from," was inspiring and entertaining in a way no onboard movie could ever hope to be. Several people had turned their heads to watch the progress of the conversation like spectators gathering to the sight of a train wreck.
In spite of himself, Aziraphale began to wish he could record a video, but some remaining string of decencies stopped him short of extracting his phone. True to his reputation, Crowley was wearing his opponent down. She had begun to crack. What was first, strong, vehement belief that he was just lying and trying to get a rise out of her, morphed into genuine concern that she had, somehow, come across a mysterious being with a religiously clean slate. To her credit, her concern did at least express itself in a more innocent way than one might fear.
"You have a chance, you know," she said finally. "This is the perfect opportunity to start your life anew. You can be saved. Learn about the Lord. I've got holy water with me. I got it from the Vatican on my trip. Let me at least baptize you."
Aziraphale stifled a groan and pinched the bridge of his nose. This is where it got dicey. On the one hand, the gesture was more or less benign, an extension of what she believed to be a kindness, far better than a blind rage or lashing out. On the other hand, his background in seminary caused a knee-jerk reaction of wanting to remind her, gently, that she did not have the authority to do that, even if she so wished in explicit detail. On the third hand, which he did not have, short of grabbing one of Crowley's to haul him back and prevent the inevitable, the shenanigans that were about to ensue were much, much more disruptive than the first 2 points made.
"I have no idea what you're talking about,"
insisted Antony. "Did you seriously think I was about to break character, Crowley?" "But sure." The woman reached down into her purse. The method actor took his moment to flash his fake husband an impish grin, and then sat up and produced an inch-tall container and a water bottle she must have bought at the gate.
"They told me in Rome that holy water blessed by the Pope can't be diluted, and that even a single drop can bless the entire container of whatever it's put in,"
she explained reverently as she poured some of it into a clear cup and upturned the half-pearl-colored bottle into it. Aziraphale cleared his throat, but Crowley elbowed him lightly as if to say, "Don't you dare interrupt."
"So, what's a bit of water gonna do now?"
he asked with his most innocent voice.
"Is it from this god character you keep mentioning?"
"In a way," she began.
"Magic, is it?"
he asked, taking the cup from her before she could do anything. He held it up to the light, squinting from behind his shades. The woman made a reach for it.
"No, it's not magic. The Pope blessed it. It has many properties, including keeping evil away."
Crowley glanced back at her.
"Evil, you say?"
At the same time, he stuck 2 fingers directly into the water, submerging them up to the knuckle. For a moment, nothing happened. Then, abruptly, Crowley hissed and looked back at the cup. Aziraphale, the woman, and at least 3 people from the audience followed his gaze. Inside the previously clear liquid, a cloud of bubbling, ink-black plumes were spreading through the water. They originated from Crowley's fingers, but very quickly obscured it and continued bubbling.
"How?"
said Crowley casually, removing his finger and shaking it.
"Oh, that wasn't very nice."
Aziraphale glanced at the woman. She was still looking at the now pitch-black liquid inside the plastic cup, pale as a sheet and frozen in shock.
"I think I'll skip out on the baptism today," Crowley continued, and then delicately placed the tainted black holy water back on her table.
"It was a nice try, darling, but it'll take a bit more than that, I'm afraid." He licked the remaining stain from his finger lightly and grinned with all his available teeth.
"Ooh, spicy."
A flurry of movement interrupted his gloating. The woman, and the cup, went tumbling to the cabin floor in a whirlwind. The cup remained where it was, but the woman made herself scarce very quickly, grabbing her bag and fleeing down the aisle with a half-choked scream. The remaining viewers looked back at Crowley, almost as if expecting a continuation, but he merely wiped his hand on his jeans and then glanced about with a neutral expression. "Show's over," he announced. "Don't worry, no one is getting downed. I'm on holiday." "Really now?" tutted Aziraphale when most of the audience had turned away and began to whisper and giggle quietly amongst themselves. There were other ways to deal with that. "Not as fun as that one," argued Crowley, settling deeper into his seat and propping his knees up again. "Besides," he added, flicking his sunglasses down his nose to look at the man beside him, "I'm not the one that came up with the idea." He reached into the oversized sleeve of the knit sweater he was wearing and withdrew a tiny aluminium square of a blister pack. One of its pockets had been punctured, and half a black, chalky tablet remained. Aziraphale held out his hand, and Crowley set it back into his palm. "Thanks for the activated charcoal, Angel." "Thought she might make you drink that water, is all," Aziraphale said, putting the tablet away into his jacket pocket and adjusting his shirt collar primly. "Who knows what was in it? Just wanted to be safe. How you put it to use is entirely on you, not me." "Whatever you say, Reverend," said Crowley, earning himself a swat on the arm. "Don't you start," scolded Aziraphale and then settled in, reopening his book again. "And put your legs down. What if the person in front of you wants to recline? There's an empty seat next to you now, and I doubt she's coming back. Use that instead." The prediction turned out to be right. The woman never did return. Whether or not she'd spoken with the stewards was not clear. One of them came over half an hour later to look around, but by that time Crowley had collected the plastic cup and wiped up some of the damage to the carpet, and so there was not much left for them to do. The flight continued rather peacefully after that, save for the moment when Crowley turned sideways and utilized the extra spot to give his long legs room to stretch and leaned against Aziraphale's arm in the process. A very steady drumbeat started up in Aziraphale's chest, but he endeavored not to react and instead continued to stare at the words on the page in front of him. He must have read the same sentence at least 15 times before he felt Crowley relax, almost imperceptibly, against him, and realized that the other must have been just as tense about the decision. It was no great matter. Leaning up against each other, that was fine. They were supposed to be married. This was one of the perks, having Crowley pressed up against him, even in a small way. Just having that point of contact, even through the fabric of his shirt sleeve, was enough. He flipped the page, and as a result, Crowley slouched further, evidently taking his lack of protest as a positive sign. At some point he fell asleep. Dinner came around, and after ordering himself a meal warily, Aziraphale argued for a few moments with the staff about getting a vegan option for his husband. It was only after the food had been surrendered and the trolley had long gone that Crowley uncoiled into a proper sitting position and stopped his pretend nap. "He didn't have to do that," he muttered. "They always mess it up anyway." "You should say something," Aziraphale argued, peeling off the aluminium cover on his chicken and pasta. "They won't know they've got it wrong if you don't." "It's fine," said Crowley. "It's not. You always do this," chided Aziraphale softly, still not looking at him. "Remember that time we went to Sarastro over by the Royal Opera House? You told them your dietary restrictions when you made reservations, and they forgot and brought you beef, and you didn't say anything then either." "Didn't want to be a bother. They were busy," countered Crowley. He opened up a steaming pile of vegetables and examined it critically before sighing. "Smells like shit, but at least it's edible. What would I do without you?" "Starve, presumably," replied Aziraphale, pushing a piece of pasta behind his cheek
and chewing on it in contemplation of Crowley's previous assessment of the word edible. In fact, I'm sometimes afraid to ask what you eat when you're on your own. I suspect dry ramen is somehow involved.
Used to do that, Crowley admitted, back at uni. Just eat the whole thing as is, upturn the flavor packet into my mouth afterward.
He demonstrated by picking up the plastic tray of his vegan meal and consuming it in a similar manner, shoveling 90% of the contents into his mouth in one go.
It's a miracle you're still alive, sighed his ear fail, watching him with a mixture of fond concern.
You're going to choke.
Move,
replied Crowley through a mouthful of what was probably rice.
Never have forgot a shirt.
Chew, dear, the long-suffering author insisted. Crowley made a few guttural noises next to him and finally seemed to get the food down. I said, he clarified, wiping the corner of his mouth with a devilish grin. I never had a problem swallowing before. There was a tense pause, and then Aziraphale moved to swat at him with his paperback, just as Crowley, having already anticipated the attack, jumped back and stood up in the aisle, stretching demonstrably.
Gonna go to the bathroom, Angel, he said. Don't miss me too much.
Don't bother coming back, called Zierfail over the top of the seat before settling back in to stab at his chicken with a disgruntled huff. He was halfway to nibbling at it when he noticed someone else was looking at him from over the top of the seat. Only the eyes and nose were visible, but it seemed to be a man in his late 20s, and even without seeing his mouth, the way his eyes crinkled in delight made it obvious that he was smiling. Men, can't live with them, can't live without them, am I right? He said. Aziraphale smiled nervously before realizing he had no reason to worry. Unlike the woman from before, this particular seat neighbor was clearly friendly. And besides, he was in the seat in front of them, which Crowley had been kicking the whole time they'd been there. So it was probably better to be thankful he wasn't striking up a conversation to air his grievances instead.
Yes, I'm afraid that's how it is.
He chuckled and then glanced up. I apologize for the earlier disturbance.
Are you kidding me?
Asked the man, pulling himself up a little bit more. The hint of a dark, curly beard made itself visible.
That was the most fun I've had on an airplane in years, and she got what was coming to her. Some people really need that sort of experience to snap them out of it.
Aziraphale hummed. Perhaps, but really, one must consider what sort of state they must be living in. Usually, they need our kindness most of all. The man considered it, looking away for a moment, and then folded his arms over the back of the seat and set his chin on them. Are you still a reverend? Ignoring the uncomfortable jump in his chest cavity, Aziraphale picked up another piece of plasticky pasta. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to eavesdrop, I just...
Oh, no, it's fine, I don't mind,
he hurried to say, though his eyes were focused on his food instead of the stranger above him. A long time ago, I was, but that's not the case anymore. My dear husband just likes to tease me about it, is all.
I'm surprised you didn't say anything to her.
That chapter of my life is over now, and not to sound too presumptuous, but in my experience, it rarely makes a difference to people who approach faith in such a militant manner. Regardless of what your beliefs are, your relationship with God should be the most private one in your life. Though, he added sheepishly, that's just my personal opinion. There was a beat of silence.
It's a pity, said the man, that you left the church, I mean. I think they could really use more people like you.
It was a kind thing to say, so ignoring the fact that it was something he would never do, Aziraphale thanked him. If I may ask, continued the man, how long have you and your husband been together? Aziraphale glanced up at this, and out of pure habit, his eyes flipped to the other passengers around them before he realized with a start it was fine. He and Crowley were supposed to be together. That was the story. Though the story hadn't exactly been well developed. Not that it was a problem. On the contrary, this was how most of their collaboration started out. Par for the course. At least he had experience building on minimal details.
6 years or so, he admitted vaguely.
It wasn't a lie. He liked not lying when he could help it. We knew each other much longer than that, though.
That's inspiring, said the man.
Under the weight of Aziraphale's gaze, he explained himself sheepishly.
Makes me feel like there's hope for people like us. You two just seem so comfortable with each other.
It must be nice finding love like that. It's rare. Something felt stuck in the back of Aziraphale's throat all of a sudden. He wanted to blame it on the airline food, but it was unlikely to be the culprit. He blinked once, twice to clear his head, and then forced a smile, hoping it passed for shy instead of resentful.
I'm very lucky to have the opportunities that I've had, he said, voice lower now.
It was still, technically, not a lie. He could have nothing. At least he knew Crowley. At least they were acquaintances. Friends? Partners? Business partners. Partners in crime, technically. But it was better than nothing. He had to remind himself over and over again to count his blessings. Though, it hasn't always been a walk in the park.
You can say that again. My parents were nutters, just like that one.
He indicated to the woman who was presumably still somewhere at the back of the plane if she hadn't attempted to jump out with a parachute by now.
It's been getting better in the recent years, though, hasn't it? Not like it was 10 years ago. I hear we might be legalizing marriage soon.
Aziraphale set aside his fork and took out his handkerchief to wipe his hands slowly.
True, he admitted in a lighter tone. Things have been looking up.
For him, things were looking up for the next 11 days at least. And really, he should be thankful. Thankful that he couldn't marry Crowley. If that had been part of the plan for their game of pretend, then he might have had to suffer through a consequential divorce as well. He knew he would not be able to bear it.
America was approximately what he expected. Loud, large, and unchanged since the last time he'd visited. As they bumbled their way off of the plane in a daze, adjusting to daylight, he let Crowley take the lead and instead struggled a few steps behind with his own carry-on in tow. The long hallways blurred into a mess of windows and blank white walls, and if someone were to ask him how he got through security, he would not be able to relate the information in any amount of detail. Still, the process was simple enough, and once they were laden with Crowley's dozen of bags again, they paused to take refuge in an alcove near some vending machines. Labels of unfamiliar candy bars stared back at them through the glass, beckoning with unknown contents. Probably high calorie, a little voice in his head that sounded suspiciously like Gabriel reminded him. He stared back, thinking about how he usually preferred to travel alone, and how odd it was to now be standing beside someone who was vehemently swearing about airport Wi-Fi, and somehow be feeling completely at peace with it. Then again, it was Crowley. He had made plenty of exceptions for him before. He checked his watch and glanced around, squinting past the crowds of people at the displays pointing to various parts of the airport.
So, it's currently 10 a.m. and we have quite a bit of time. They said they wouldn't be able to meet us here, he added. And I didn't really want them to, so we'll have to find some sort of bus up to, what was it again? New Hampshire?
We're in America, Angel. It's a 5-hour drive. No buses, replied Crowley, who was jabbing at something on a sleek black smartphone.
We're going by car. Aziraphale looked up and blinked at him.
A car? He asked.
Where are we supposed to get a car?
At the car rental. I made a reservation.
And where, pray tell, continued Aziraphale with practiced patience, are you planning to get an American driver's license?
Crowley rolled his head lazily towards him and reached into his back pocket before procuring a curious piece of what looked to be a hardback gray paper with an official-looking red stamp on it.
No need for prayer. International driver's permit should do it, I think.
Aziraphale looked at it, looked back at Crowley, and heaved a deep sigh.
At least you have some sort of document this time. Though, I think I will pray, he added.
Might increase our chances of survival. You never know.
You're going to exorcise me on accident, is what you'll do.
Bold of you to assume I can exorcise you, even on purpose, replied Aziraphale, and they turned around, gathered up their things, and went along down the way that was specifically labeled with the sign, Airport Car Rental. The one advantage of being in a foreign land where no one knew them was that there was no way for the pleasant girl behind the counter to realize what sort of mistake she was making as she handed over the keys to a grinning Crowley. Aziraphale tried to hold off on making a comment, but as they descended to the garage and followed the map to the parking space where the vehicle was apparently waiting for them, he couldn't help but groaning at the sight of the jet-black, angular monster on wheels.
A jeep? Really? He asked, standing off to the side to watch the bags flying into a pile in the boot one after the other.
Aren't these supposed to be for off-road use? We are not going camping.
It's a car, just like any other, said Crowley from somewhere in the back seat. His long legs were sticking out the door for a moment, and then he righted himself again. Besides, it's sturdy.
How self-aware of you, quipped Aziraphale. But he got into the passenger seat all the same.
The drive was less perilous than he'd originally thought. The mass of the jeep did help to calm his nerves some, and Crowley only played the, oops, which side of the road am I supposed to be on again, trick once. For the most part, they fought with the GPS instead of each other, and once Aziraphale got peckish and requested a pit stop, Crowley was kind enough to make it up to him by turning into what turned out to be a rather lovely side-of-the-road Waffle House. Following lunch, keeping their eyes open became a more pressing issue, however.
You didn't really sleep on the plane at all, did you?
Asked Aziraphale, staring determinedly at the canopy of trees rushing by just outside the window, fighting off the urge to yawn.
He hadn't slept at all either, though in his case the possibility of nodding off was far less perilous.
Maybe we should find a place to stay for the night.
Nah, I'm fine, insisted Crowley, though he was also blinking rather forcefully from behind his sunglasses.
It's already been nearly 20 hours. At this point it's best to keep going till nightfall. I'm about to catch my second wind anyway. I'll just put on some music.
After a bit of poking around with the radio, they finally settled on a station that seemed to be determinedly playing one Queen song after another, which Crowley finally agreed was the most acceptable option given that their only others were a classical musical channel and a religious talk show currently in the middle of discussing who was going to hell.
Already there, thanks, Crowley had sneered, and then looked over at Aziraphale guiltily.
I'm not talking about you, Angel.
I know, dear, mumbled Aziraphale, too sleepy at that point to keep up with what was happening.
He heard Crowley fumbling with the dial, and then the opening chords of Crazy Little Thing Called Love filtered through the speakers again. A small part of his brain that was still more or less awake wondered why they were keeping up the nicknames in private, where no one needed to hear them. Habit, he finally decided for himself. It was good to make a habit of it so they wouldn't slip up later on. It wasn't as if he was worried about being questioned too much,
Surely the last thing the uptight American diplomat would be worried about was what pet names he used for his spouse. In fact, it was likely he wouldn't care for any display of affection between two men at all. That was a relief, Aziraphale thought, willfully, ignoring the part of himself that actually found that it was disappointed with this prospect. He was greedy, it was true. He had hoped to get away with at least some hand-holding. Surely Crowley would forgive him that. After all, he had curled up against Aziraphale's shoulder on the plane without complaining. So perhaps small acts of physical affection weren't off-limits. Not that they'd discussed it. That was the other problem. They had barely even talked about the trip at all since agreeing to the matter on that fateful evening of drinking together. Everything else had been done through emails that were barely a full sentence. Prices, names to put down on plane tickets. They hadn't even bothered to get... rings... gasped Aziraphale. He tried to peel open his eyes as his brain function came back online after what had been, apparently, the middle of a nap. Beside him, there was an odd shuffling of movement, but it was otherwise relatively quiet. The music station had evidently been shut off. He brought his hands up to his face to rub at it, and then finally resurfaced into a state that could be more or less described as wakefulness. The action wasn't entirely helpful. Everything was dark for some reason, even when he opened his eyes. He looked around blearily at the windows and then over at Crowley, who was behind the wheel, sitting very still and staring very intently at his phone. "Why aren't we moving?" he asked. "Is something the matter?" "Trip's over. We're here," said Crowley, still not looking up. "This should be the place. I was about to wake you up." "Oh, I'm sorry," mumbled Aziraphale, right before drowning the latter half of the apology in a yawn. "I didn't even realize I'd nodded off." He leaned forward to get a better look from the windshield and instead saw mostly white. The wipers were dancing back and forth to clear the snow, but in a hole in the cloud somewhere above them, he could catch a glimpse of a brilliantly black stardust-speckled sky framed by the noble edges of evergreens. "Goodness," he hummed. "We're really out in the country, aren't we?"
"Middle of nowhere, you mean?" said Crowley. He looked up from his phone and to his left and then over his shoulder. "Shit, this should be it, but there's a chain up. Maybe we'll have to walk."
"Not far, I should hope. It's really coming down. I should try to ring them up before we head out, just so we don't get lost wandering in the woods in the middle of a blizzard." Crowley turned back to him, and although it looked like for a second he was about to kill the engine, he stopped short instead, staring at Aziraphale with a very curious, closed-off expression. "Ring them up," he muttered, as if remembering something.
"Wait a second. What was it you said just a moment ago?"
The soft light from the dashboard of the car drew a single, jagged line of orange atop his brow as it aimed downward.
"Something about rings."
Oh. Aziraphale would have leapt forward, but a seatbelt kept him firmly in place.
"The rings," he said. "We forgot about the rings, Crowley. Wedding rings."
Crowley's scowl returned for a moment. "I actually did think about that," he admitted, his face oddly flushed. "Then I figured if we bought them new, it would look even more fake, and anyway, sometimes people don't wear rings."
"I think it's better to have something," insisted Aziraphale, looking around as if he hoped to discover a box placed on top of the dashboard. "You wear jewelry, don't you?" he asked finally. "You have rings, I know you do. I've seen you wear them."
"Not any for my ring finger," muttered Crowley, though he immediately undid his seatbelt and slithered in between the two front seats into the back to reach for one of his bags.
Aziraphale glanced down, and finding his eyes full of a very pleasant view of a firm buttocks, Hurley averted his gaze and pressed himself back into the seat, redirecting his attention to his lap instead, and twisting his fingers together to keep his mind off whatever else was within reach.
Well, we could improvise, or...
His hands stopped their fidgeting for a moment, only enough to brush the edge of a familiar piece of metal. Right there, on his pinky. He became very still, and then with deliberate slowness, twisted the signet ring around his knuckle and slipped it off. The worn gold glinted just slightly in the dim light of the car. It was too small to fit his own ring finger, but...
Crowley, he said.
Give me a second, answered Crowley, arse still stuck in the air between the seats in the most tantalizing way possible. If he didn't know any better, Aziraphale would have thought he was doing it on purpose.
All I've got is my old class ring. That's got a stone in it, and my acrylic one, the rest are silver. Oh, and this thumb ring, but it's...
Crowley, insisted Aziraphale again and cleared his throat meaningfully.
Dear, sit up for a moment.
The man tensed and then slowly pushed himself up, dislodging the slender body from the gap to meet eyes with the other again. In the process of rummaging around in the bag, he had pushed his shades up into his hair, and Aziraphale now had the privilege of seeing his eyes, which were far more unguarded than he'd been prepared for. For a second, his breath caught. Crowley looked flustered. His pupils were dilated, although that was almost certainly from the fact it was dark in the car itself. Surely it had little to do with what Aziraphale very nearly called him.
Sorry,
he said immediately, feeling something coil hungrily in his stomach. The proximity the car was forcing upon them was beginning to feel stifling. He had perfected his self-control over the years, but Crowley wasn't exactly making it easy.
I just had an idea. Give me your hand.
Swallowing audibly, Crowley slid back into his seat and held out his arm. A bridge across the empty void between them. There was barely even the sound of their breathing, yet Aziraphale thought he could hear the crackle of nervous energy surging through him like electricity as he reached out. When had they last held hands? Memories of the walk back from the garden swam back to him, blurry, almost completely smeared with the passing of time, but still intact. He had tried to heat Crowley's freezing fingers up inside his own, and they'd laughed about it, made some sort of obscene joke that had led to a slow, gentle kiss. The first of many that had started that night. Not that it would happen now, he knew. But still, it was a nice memory, something he could hold on to. He pushed the thought to the back of his mind and gently slid his thumb over Crowley's knuckles. In response, Crowley's fingers twitched and curled around his own. The deepest human instinct, the one babies acquire in the earliest stages of their infancy, to grab, to hold, to pull closer. No amount of intent could be assigned to it. It was simply something that had been passed down through ancestry. A survival instinct. A biologically neutral reaction. They both held still for a moment, until Aziraphale realized he had been planning to do something, and that plan hadn't been sit there like a fool holding Crowley's hand.
Let's try this.
He forced out through the lump in his throat and, nudging Crowley's ring finger up just a bit, eased his own golden band over it. There was a gentle pushback at the bony knuckle, but Aziraphale pressed forward, giving it a gentle twist, and it slid home. Crowley shuddered. It wasn't an obvious thing, but it was enough to yank Aziraphale's eyes back up.
Is that?
Asked Crowley, visibly struggling to remain very casual, despite the strangely intense tone his voice was taking.
Is that an ecclesiarch?
He cleared his throat and seemed to give up. Ecclesiastical, said Aziraphale, pulling away hurriedly, wondering if his hands had overstayed his welcome.
No, it's a family heirloom. Yes, but it's just an antique that I kept for the aesthetic. The intent behind it is quite secular. Don't worry. I wasn't worried,
Crowley muttered thickly.
I haven't burst into flames yet, so can't be that bad.
Aziraphale smiled. It looks old, so it'll do. I don't need one. We can just say I've gained a bit of weight and it doesn't fit me anymore. It's true anyway. He began to pull back and then stopped, realizing that despite having not said anything, Crowley's right hand had been clenched into a fist on his knee the entire time. It seemed he was holding something in it. Said Crowley eloquently, and then, as if to explain, Yes, said Aziraphale. He was more or less used to interpreting the man's half-words after nearly a decade of listening to him stumble around, massacring the English language into half-broken syllables and mangled consonant clusters.
Did you find another one? If you want to wear that instead, I understand. No,
muttered Crowley and turned his fist over, unfurling his hand. In the middle of his palm lay a band. It wasn't gold, but instead dark metal, long and thin, twisting around once and then overlapping with itself. The details were worn thin, but the serpent head and tapered tail was evident, even from a distance.
It's just this.
Aziraphale leaned forward.
Oh, your snake thumb ring, he said. That's nice as well.
Voiced Crowley, practically writhing with some sort of indecision.
I thought maybe... No, forget it. It was a stupid idea.
Aziraphale, observing him curiously now, reached out and plucked the elegant band from his hand.
Do you think it's large enough to fit me? We could try, but...
No, protested Crowley and grabbed for him. For a second, Aziraphale froze, unable to stop the icy cold pang of hurt at the way Crowley's voice sounded. But before he could register any amount of self-pity, Crowley had taken his left wrist and connected them together again. His palm was sweaty, grip clutching almost too hard.
No, I wanna put it on you.
He finished, voice barely audible. The cold, stinging frost that had formed in Aziraphale's chest from the previous moment of rejection didn't bother to do the polite thing and melt. Instead, it bypassed the liquid stage altogether and boiled directly into steam, heating him up from the inside and pushing the color into his face, into his ears, into his neck. He was certain that within moments of hearing those words, he was as red as a tomato, with no defenses left to deny it.
Oh!
He choked out.
You put yours on me, so it would only be fair,
defended Crowley. It would have been a lot more convincing if he wasn't shivering like a leaf in the autumn wind.
Besides, it's, for authenticity's sake.
The fingers on the wrist loosened and slipped under the palm instead, splaying the fingers.
Authenticity,
repeated Aziraphale numbly.
Yeah,
said Crowley, edging the ring over the first tip of his knuckle. He kept talking as if to distract the other from what was actually happening at all costs. You know me, big on romantic tropes. Might write this into my next short story. Had to see what all the fuss was about.
Fuss, echoed Aziraphale, who was not capable of passing the Turing test in his current state. At last, he succeeded in molding his face into something resembling amusement, as if he were amused at this display of romantic tropes.
Yes, very fussy you are, all about the tropes.
Well, we do have everything we need right here. Rings, a priest.
I'm not, even if I was, still Catholicism.
Angel, humor me for a second,
Crowley said, though his voice held the faintest note of panic. The reason for it was revealed when Aziraphale looked down. The ring was stuck on the penultimate knuckle and seemed to be resisting going any further. This brought about a newly redoubled bout of shivering, until he reached down and covered Crowley's hand with his own.
You have to put a little more force into it, he mumbled, and pressed his finger in until the metal was nested at the base.
There, he said, ignoring the soft, barely noticeable hiss of air escaping from between Crowley's clenched teeth.
Is that enough of a trope for you? You may now kiss the...
Crowley's gaze snapped up, and he hadn't been fast enough in looking away, so their eyes met again. It was then, with a start, that Aziraphale realized that the whole time they'd only been a few inches apart. The planets had aligned, metaphorically speaking. The steady, looping orbit they'd been dancing around each other in light years of open space had drawn them closer again, enough for a glimpse into each other's atmosphere as they passed by. The magnetism of it was undeniable, and the friction of their gravitational fields glancing off each other in the consequent proximity was generating heat that threatened to burn them both. Close up, Crowley was just as ridiculously attractive as he had always been, face lined with barely noticeable traces of stress, the hint of stubble along the edge of his jaw, the sharp turn down of his nose, his lips, usually pulled taut with whatever ventriloquism he was prepared to put on for the sake of keeping up appearances, was slack for once, soft and open, and maybe this was Aziraphale's wistful thinking. Inviting. The inner part of his repressed desire roared with outrage. How could he be gone so long without this? How could he fight against it? There was nothing but want inside of him, singeing his insides and clawing its way to the outside world, reaching for the man across from him. He wanted, he needed, Crowley to touch him like he needed air to breathe. To turn away now would be to sentence himself to death by yearning. Without thinking, he tilted his head to the side. The memory of their lips touching was 6 years old, and yet his body seemed to have no trouble recalling the movement required to angle his nose just a bit to the left, in order to give Crowley room to move in and slot his mouth into.
Knock, knock, knock.
Oi!
If it were humanly possible to jump out of his skin, Aziraphale would have. As it were, he had to settle for the much less dramatic equivalent of yanking himself back by an invisible fishing line and mirroring the shocked, half-drunk expression Crowley was making at him from the opposite side of the car. They were completely still for a moment, and then the knocking came again, against the fogged-up driver's side window. After Crowley flailed his way through several pretzel-like shapes, he managed to realize what was going on and slapped at the buttons on the side of the door to lower the glass. As the wall of condensation edged downwards, it revealed what seemed to be the face of an older man, wrapped in a scarf and a burly hat caked in heavy crusts of snow. "Mr. Fell?" grunted the man, eyeing the red-haired driver doubtfully.
"Not yet," muttered Crowley, and his ear failed aloud himself for an indulgent moment to believe that his companions sounded put out about the fact that they'd been interrupted, as if the name change had been next on the agenda, shortly following the impromptu ceremony.
"I'm Mr. Fell," he said. It was incredible how composed he sounded, even while trying to shake off the intense embarrassment and shock of what had almost happened. The man in the window glanced at him and seemed to find this more believable.
"Mr. Dowling?"
"Mr. Dowling is at the house," said the man. "They sent me to look for you, since the storm was getting worse. Figured you'd get turned around."
Quite right," said his ear fail, sitting up and tugging on his waistcoat to get it back into shape. His fingers grasped for the ring on his pinky, but finding it bare, recalibrated their efforts on the new piece on his left hand instead. The smooth, snake-scale texture was far less calming than he'd anticipated. It instead only served to remind him of what had just happened, threatening to recall the blush he'd been valiantly dodging.
We did get turned around, I'm afraid. Will we have to walk far?"
"Nah," said the groundskeeper, for it appeared that's what he was, and pointed vaguely behind them.
"Just back up to that last turn and follow me. I put a lamp up for the driveway. Should be easier to spot now."
"Thanks," replied Crowley, and then, without fully waiting for the other to turn away, began to roll the window back up again. Once it locked with a click, he looked back at his ear fail for a brief second. His sunglasses were already back over his eyes, a wall between whatever emotions may have been brewing just behind it. Just as quickly, he redirected his attention to the gear shift in order to put the Jeep into reverse. As his palm skimmed in a slow arc across the steering wheel, his ear fail's ring caught the light.
"I shouldn't. I can't. I won't,"
chanted Aziraphale to himself, staring relentlessly. Then, not without considerable effort, he tore his gaze away. It was going to be a long 11 days. End of part 4.